beautiful clip that we looked at last time.
Okay.
So, send these around.
Same as last time, but people didn't want to schlep them around for a whole week, so.
Or we're afraid to not. We're not here last week.
No, understood. For those who were here.
Back. Yeah, so you want these packed then?
No, I don't want it back.
Oh, but yeah.
And last time people only handed to me if they didn't want to.
I forgot.
They didn't want to hold on to me for the week. You can keep everything.
This is very interesting.
So your teachings are just the next two Tuesdays, right? And then you're done?
No. Then we pick up with the next topic, which is in poetry. We have several topics. We also have guests. I don't have the schedule with me. Oh. Now we're also doing something on commentary, on Kabbalah,
So there was Tuesdays continuing December, January.
Right, I don't remember the date.
They're clusters.
Next week is the Thanksgiving service.
Right,
I couldn't schedule, when I had to reschedule, I couldn't schedule opposite that. And so it's the 28th.
Okay.
And then in December, I don't remember the dates. We have sessions in December also.
Okay, I know where to find it. I'll find it.
Okay. And I certainly can remind everyone the following week. And we can decide to shift things. And I think it's amazing. But I told you there's also a woman I wanted to teach about. We have to teach about her too. So I will have to make room. So I don't know how. Okay. So we're on page 33. The numbers are on the outside margins. So 32, 33. That's my notes from last time. And this particular, for those who weren't here last time, I included the introduction to this volume, or most of the introduction to this volume, and it's beautiful. We read much of it last week. It's absolutely fantastic. It's beautiful. So I encourage you to read it.
I mean, page.
Right. Which is, he takes the title of the anthology from Solomon Ibn Gabirol's self-description. Okay. And someone like to read? Okay. Page 33. This one's only one page. And Ellen, would you like to read?
My sword and spear are in my mouth. My lips are shield and buckler. My poems hammer hearers' hearts. They smash, crush granite when I rage. To friends I can be milk and honey, venom to anyone who crosses me. My heart is always wakeful and my eyes are open ever, sleeps no pleasure. Sapience is mother to my soul, wisdom is my sister. She is the one I treasure more than pearls. The world is just my concubine, a harlot pleased to spend one day with me, one day with someone else. I don't pursue her, for I've made my rule to cherish only what is truly mine. My heart, my only stake in all her treasures, and all I own of all her goods, my soul.
That's beautiful.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So, again, we are all pretty much on the same, the same, playing field here. And he's playing off, again, Arabic poetry and the conventions of his day. Again, for those of you who are new, he smashes the conventions. He's, in that sense, he's a postmodern poet, and smashing the conventions. He's a genius. And so, together, what do you see here?
The one that gets me is, to friends there can be milk and honey, venom to anyone who crosses me. But didn't he say wasn't it said that he had no friends or almost no friends?
Well,
yeah. That's why.
Mm-hmm. So. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Helen.
The similarity to biblical poetry the couplets is very pronounced. And just glancing at the first line in Hebrew, it looks like there's a lot of alliteration, which the English gets a little bit with sword and spear, but
right.
Could I ask you to please read the first line so we can hear it?
Befi harbi uvilshoni chaniti.
Now, maybe he continues like that, but it must enhance the
bump. The pounding of that hammer.
It's E, right? At the end of the line in Hebrew, looks like there's...
Mm-hmm.
Just in the beginning.
Every other line.
The rhyming scheme is very deliberate. Again, I cannot explain to you the Arabic meter and rhyme that he's playing against. I don't know it, but he is.
So is this a Hebrew translation of... No, he wrote in Hebrew.
He wrote in Hebrew.
But he used the Arabic rhyme scheme.
Right.
Wow.
So again, for those, forgive the repetition, these poets were pretty much the masters of all knowledge that was accessible in the Western world. In his case, he mastered all those fields with the exception of medicine, from what I've read about him. But the other sciences, mathematics, grammar, and astronomy, and Greek, Latin, Arabic, Hebrew, Ladino.
Did he speak all those languages?
He's a master of all those languages.
Well, we said the philosophical...
And philosophy.
...paper that he wrote was in Arabic.
Right.
But yet his poetry was in Hebrew. Did he write any poetry in Arabic?
I don't know. He wrote in Arabic, clearly. I don't know if he wrote Arabic poetry. I don't know. That's a good question.
It seems very sad.
Is there something in particular?
Well, anger, loneliness, futility, very closed off and not wanting to reach out to other human beings.
He describes himself.
Does he?
As a vulture in a cage. As angry. His those who knew him describe him as a very angry man.
Do we know what he was so angry about? What was he angry about?
He wasn't well. He was frail.
Yeah, right. Well, he was apparently short and ugly. Hence again the self-description of a vulture, and was plagued with disease, with a skin disease that. Is described as tuberculosis of the skin.
Oh.
But it's not diagnosed. That is, it's not possible. People try to guess at what it might have been. But boils, and he was in agony. And so, again, from what we read and last time, he was also angry because he was so much better than everybody else. And, people wrote the same way about the same things, and he was a genius. And he felt himself so far in another world and so far superior that also angered him. He was very arrogant. Pardon me?
That isolates him.
Mm-hmm. How old was he when his parents died?
Again, I have two different accounts. One was he was... in like 5 or 6, and the other as a young, and this, the Andalusian alphabet, dates him as a young teenager.
Oh, in any case, it would be.
Yeah, he was orphaned, arrogant, and miserable, is how he's described.
Well, look, I mean,
it sounds like he had good reason to be miserable.
But his heart is always wakeful, his eyes are never open.
I'm sorry?
The part, like, his heart is always wakeful, his eyes are always open. He can't. That also reminds me of that sort of vulture kind of picture, and he's like looking and he only trusts his wisdom, his knowledge,
right?
He said the world is my concubine. I mean, he didn't trust the world. He didn't really want to be part of the world. It wasn't real for him.
Right here today, and with somebody else tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I've made my rule to cherish only what is truly mine, but he didn't seem to have much.
His heart and soul
Well, it's hard. I don't know about that. What does he have? What is truly his?
His intellect.
Right.
His soul.
His heart.
His heart and
his intellect.
Soul.
Right. It's his soul.
Right.
And beholden to nobody.
But we don't know what kind of person he was. Maybe nobody liked him.
But we know that.
But we know some. We do know some of
people. People did.
People wrote a lot about him, like, and he wrote a lot about himself.
Oh, okay.
Anything else that stands out to you? Pardon me?
He's been betrayed at some point. Not trusting.
If not in reality, but at least in his head. In his imagination.
Yeah.
That he has been. It's a good word.
Yeah.
He could have used some antidepressant pills.
I was thinking in a realistic way that maybe he really did also have a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when he talks about my heart is always wakeful, my eyes are open. That sometimes is the sign of a mental illness.
Well, it sounds like anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. They're flip sides of the same coin. And it sounds like he would have every right to be experiencing this.
In general, if you know biblical literature, and you do, who is the one who is treasured more than pearls?
A woman.
Right. A woman of valor.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's another woman he's treasuring more than pearls, and she's not, the woman of valor is an earthly woman, and he has no interest. She's a concubine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another woman he treasures, and she is?
Wisdom.
Chochmah, wisdom. The feminine noun. Next poem. Somebody want to read? Who said I? Thank you, Leslie. I just didn't know where the sound came from.
My song has been displaced by sorrow. My joy is crowded out by sighs. Whenever I see laughter, my heart weeps because my life is being plucked away from me. You're just 16, my friend. Is this the time to weep and mourn about the day of gathering? At your age, better be swept away by one with sun-drenched rosy cheeks. My heart has governed me since boyhood, subordinated all my appetites. It made its choice for wisdom and for learning. Made my appetite its anger's object. But what's the good of anger? Just be still and hope for every ailment has a cure? What use is there in weeping over hardships? What value has the tear down?
That's it. That's the one.
Interesting.
Mm.
So sort of a change of perspective of it all.
Mm. Yeah. More introspective there and sort of telling whoever he's addressing this poem to.
Well, he has that interlocutor that we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. This is someone who is responding to him in this poem.
It's not. So the second stanza is someone speaking to
him. The second and the fourth are responses to him.
I didn't
understand.
Oh, I didn't get that either.
Oh, there was
one. Yeah,
his own.
Right, so. Should we read it again?
Yes.
Leslie, read it again, okay? Thank you.
My song has been displaced by sorrow. My joy is crowded out by sighs. Whenever I see laughter, my heart weeps because my life is being plucked away from me. You're just 16, my friend. Is this a time to weep and mourn about the day of gathering? At your age, better to be swept away by one with sun-drenched rosy cheeks. My heart has governed me since boyhood, subordinated all my appetites. It made its choice for wisdom and for learning, made my appetites its anger's object. But what's the good of anger? Just be still and hope, for every ailment has a cure. What use is there in weeping over hardships? What value has the tear down for?
Maybe it's Ibn Gabrol talking to himself.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say certainly. I agree with you.
Well, and this was the time, perhaps, that he was orphaned, right? I mean,
Right, he's on his own. Well, he's still with the Akuchiel, his patron. But his earliest poems are that we have are from the time he was 16. I think we looked at another one also. Maybe in the introduction we looked at another one. But the responder, the interlocutor, is saying, "You're just 16, my friend. Why are you thinking about death? Your death now. You know, now's the time to be chasing after girls."
But if he's physically repulsive, and he knows it, you know, no girl's going to love him. He knows that. No one would love him. And without money, no one would be wed to him, even if he was interested. So all those 16-year-old appetites for love and romantic interest and, you know, sexual life and you know, drinking and carousing are completely unavailable to him, even though he still has those appetites.
And they are, right, the object of his anger.
And that then makes him so mad because it's not his fault. You know, I mean, he's given this ugly body and short whatever it is, and whatever this disease is, obviously something which is not a sympathetic disease. It's repulsive. I mean, skin diseases are very repulsive to people. So.
So when he talks about his heart, I think we talked about this last time, but I don't, he's not talking about it like we would as a place. He's talking about it as a repository of wisdom.
Right.
Intellect.
His intellect.
He sees himself as an outsider. Because he says, whenever I see laughter, doesn't hear laughter. He's looking at a scene with people laughing. So he's an outsider.
If this is so contemporary in sound, it's striking.
Right, he's a Jewish genius. Really outside his time. He was not limited by time in his poetry, by any of the conventions. Again, he uses the conventions of meter and rhyme, but nothing else. That's beautiful.
Wouldn't he be amazed that we're talking about him?
I'm amazed that we are. How do these things get preserved?
It would probably make him one thing that would make him happy.
Yeah.
No, this
no, but no. Chair, what about his religious beliefs?
We're going to get there. But not yet. We have them here.
Sure. Yes. I don't recall, how were these poems organized in this anthology? Are they by subject? Are they chronological?
These are by subject. And there were four or five. The table of contents are his choice, the editor anthologizer's choice, ambition, sickly body, sorrowing soul. We're still in that section. Patrons, friends, and enemies. I don't think I chose any in that section. Maybe I did. I don't remember. Maybe not. Nature, wine, and eros. I didn't initially. I came back. I have some. And devotional poems. I wanted to get to. Okay. And the next one. A reader.
Is that 147?
147.
The mind is flawed, the way to wisdom locked. The flesh alone is seen, the soul is hidden. Men who seek the world find only evil. A man can get no pleasure here on earth. The servant rises up and kills his lord. Serving girls attack their mistresses. Sons rise up to strike their parents. Even girls lift hands in violence against their elders. My friend, from what I've seen of life, I'd say the best that you can hope is to go mad. However long you live, you suffer toil. And in the end, you suffer worms and rot until the day when clay goes back to clay, until the soul ascends to join the soul.
Interesting.
Wow.
He's depressed.
Yeah,
super depressed. But it's a beautiful poem. Sad.
He's also mirroring the life of the court. And you really were at the mercy of political rivalries and court intrigue. And you could be in someone's favor one day and dead the next. if you antagonized the wrong person, said the wrong thing. So I think we read about some of that in the introduction or heard some in Simon Sharma's This Was the Life of the Court. So his mirror of that is also important to see.
The last word of the poem, mm-hmm. in the Hebrew, it's La Nishama.
All right, Nishama and Nishama both.
Okay, so Shema, I hear Shem, the name, is that the root?
No, yeah. Nishama, like Elohai, Elohai, Nishama.
Ah, okay.
The soul. Nishama, soul, from the root to breathe.
Soul to the soul.
Okay,
Nishom.
So I was thinking of Nefesh.
Another word for soul.
But different origin.
Nefesh, and Nefesh actually comes from the word that means throat. So, not unrelated to breath, too. But you count each nefesh, each person also. Like, how many nefeshot are there here? How many people are there here? Mm-hmm. And neshama, vita'al ha-neshama la-neshama, the soul to the soul.
And Alan, I was thinking about your writing in the the Siddur, until the soul ascends to join the soul. It reminded me of that.
But the other thing about that last line is why the translator has the first soul in lowercase and the second one in uppercase. There is no case in Hebrew, so it's an interesting choice.
It's a choice based on the study of Ibn Gabirol and his philosophy. Mm. So it's pretty accurate.
Okay.
It's an important part of his view.
Meaning the divine soul.
Right. And we read a poem earlier. I think we did. It's hard to remember. In putting things together, I'm not sure anymore the sequence of things of his relationship to the soul. Maybe we'll get to there. Maybe in his religious poetry. Let's keep going. Wait, right there. Hang on.
So depressed, he couldn't write more than
some of his major opuses. For example, he has a treatise on grammar that are 400 verses in rhyme of all the rules of grammar, but only part of it survives. But it's clear from either other people's descriptions of it or what the fragments that survive. So short wasn't necessarily. I mean, he could also create, write opuses, opi, on whatever the and major philosophical treatises. So we're actually going to look at a longer poem and on one of his, which I brought too, very long. Okay, I tried to go for short also because it's easier for us than page after page. Mm-hmm. So I chose some that, because of their brevity, they were easier to wrap, put our hands around. But I did bring a longer one, which we'll get to in a minute or two. Okay. Ellen, you want to read?
Sure. Since all life's joys are doomed to end in sorrow, and all life's pleasures end in dirt and pain, since all man's days are nothing but a shadow, and man is destined to be smashed like pottery, why should we seek anything but God? Nothing else in life is worth the doing.
So what he did, the end is not so sad, is it?
No, that's the last line has some redemptive value to it.
And reason for doing it is pretty sad.
Pardon me?
No.
The reason for doing it.
God is pretty sad.
Yes, but it's completely opposite of everybody else.
Right, so say that, right, he's in a very sensual world, which we'll take a look at it again. I skipped that whole section.
But even today, I mean, people say, listen to God, take what you can get now, because this is the only life you're going to get. So, eat, drink, and be merry, because this is it, there's nothing else, and he's saying exactly the opposite.
And how about the choices people are making today all around us to opt for a more fundamentalist religious life? People who come from educated backgrounds, who are giving it all up, why are they doing that?
Because that other stuff really doesn't happen.
Because man's days are nothing but a shadow.
And maybe they want to tap into something which feels like it is eternal.
But
and this, all this stuff is going to... You know, what is it?
Isn't
but
that
you,
Shakespeare?
There's, pardon me?
Isn't that Shakespeare? No, something all a man is, something about on a stage.
Life is but a walking shadow, poor player who struts
just
and presses out upon
the stage. And then
it's
more.
Yeah.
So, there are people all around us as a move away from... You know, when everything you've always wanted isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a move toward the life of the spirit. And for some, and not for some, for a lot of people on this planet right now, the life of the spirit seems more real than the life of acquisition and of sensual experience. Pardon me?
Profound and fury.
Material satisfaction or something beyond the corporeal life.
It depends where you are in the where. You could be in a hovel in India, and you know, or an ashram in India. You could be in, you know, a shtetl in Mea Shearim, and
there's also a big move towards tiny homes now. People are getting rid of all the excess and
really?
Yeah.
But it's not
anyway,
it's
I
not
yes, there's also hypocrisy, and if you can do that life and be very wealthy, then good for you. Yes, that's for sure. And I'm not subscribing to it, and I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in it.
So
if that's what you're implying,
isn't
I don't
that,
know if you were, but
sorry. Isn't there also sometimes cults where you? It's not only giving yourself to spirituality, but giving yourself so that somebody else is making all the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to anymore.
That's not the focus of this particular poem?
Yes.
A fundamentalist, you know, a fundamentalist who's willing to blow himself up, doesn't care about here and now, they have a problem.
That's right. That's right. So none of that matters. That is not as real as whatever else he or she feels they're tapping into. Right.
That's a very
mm-hmm.
The
so nothing else in life is worth the doing, he says.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what
yeah.
I'm sorry?
Ecclesiastes. That's what I was thinking.
The second to last Hebrew line, the next to the last word, if I'm reading this right, it's Shaddai.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how he's, that's what he's
case,
using for God?
In this particular line. He has many names for God. Why Shaddai here? There may be a reason for meters, you know, for meter. And again, I can't respond on that level.
You know, to some extent, what you told us about his life and how he was sustained by the largesse of patrons, and he doesn't have to worry about anything. I mean, I think people who have to spend their time and on earth and life struggling to stay alive can't afford the luxury that's reflected in this poetry of just the mind and aspiring to be one with the soul. And
unless you're Gandhi.
Unless you're Gandhi.
Mahatma Gandhi, who renounced the physical world and lived in a small little house and, you know, spun cotton and had a simple white garment and devoted the rest of his life to mobilizing the spirit and the spirit within people. So I don't know. Is that,
there was also Van Gogh, who gave himself over to his painting, you know, made no money, was constantly asking his brother for money. I see, and perhaps had some madness as well. That's what this reminds me of.
Next one. This was referred to earlier in the introduction. It's good to read the whole poem. Joyce, you want to read?
Sure. I'm loyal to my friends with all my heart. I always honor those who honor me. My tongue is sharp as any court scribe's pen, to praise a friend, to crush an enemy. Wow. This is kind of curious compared to the other ones.
Well, he knows the power of his writing, and he's, as he said before, it's milk and honey or venom, depending.
Mm. He's asking for respect when he makes these sort of comments. He's, not asking, but wanting to draw in respect from out there, exterior world, in the world. That's how I see it all. It's almost like a bear.
Right.
Yes.
That's what I mean.
Treat me well. A dare or a threat.
Or also a plea to be noticed, to say there's another side of me. There's a loyal side of me that not everybody sees, but is there.
But it's also saying you need to be loyal to me.
And how easy is it to maintain that loyalty? I mean, how easy is it for him to read in anything an act of treason on the part of a friend? And a note of criticism or need would be interpreted as
slighted me.
Right.
And now I'm going to lash out with my pen.
Right.
Or,
it's more how it feels. Next one. Anyone else want to read?
I'll read.
Okay, thank you,
Beth. Did you dare to plagiarize my verses, burrow under, break through boundary fences, use my lines for your aggrandizement, thinking they would help you out in trouble? Can mere mortals rise into the sky and hide the sun and moon and stars from earthlings? To me, your act of theft is nothing. In a bucket empty out the ocean. So there. Guys, humbly walking with that guy.
Right.
Very humbly.
That is a great line.
In a bucket. To remember that one.
You're mortal.
Right. The paper says orphan, arrogant, and. Okay, next one. Now we're moving into another section. And I think when we read Shanlin's introduction, again, I'm sorry that I don't exactly remember where we read everything, where I read, in spite of his inability to relate and to people, his poems to God are incredibly intimate. So he is the first in 2,000 years or 2,500 years to write an intimate address to God. And so in poems, so outside the liturgical framework, to write an intimate address. Some of these poems become prayers and are preserved in largely in Sephardic prayer books. This is, after all, Sepharad. So in the Sephardic liturgy, and we'll look at some of them that are preserved in the prayer book and made their way into the Ashkenazi prayer book too. And this is a poem. This doesn't become a prayer. And here again, the Almighty One is addressed as Shaddai. Somebody want to read? Thank you.
Almighty One, who hears a poor man's prayer, how long will you keep hidden far from me? I pray in sorrow day and night with loyal heart, thanking you for your abundant grace. I place my hopes in you, O King, my heart secure, like one who dreams of dreams obscure, trusting the interpreter. So here is what I ask. Just hear my prayer. I ask for nothing less and nothing more.
Don't hide your face.
Almighty One, who hears a poor man's prayer, how long will you keep hidden far from me? I pray in sorrow day and night with loyal heart, thanking you for your abundant grace. I place my hopes in you, O King, my heart secure, like one who dreams a dream obscure, trusting the interpreter. So here is what I ask. Just hear my prayer. I ask for nothing less and nothing more.
It's a smidge of arrogance there at the end. Hear my prayer. I ask for nothing less.
He starts with less rather than more.
Except he didn't say, just answer my prayer. He said, just hear it.
But
that's significant.
Yeah.
But I ask, you know, you better hear it. There's no or else, but I ask for nothing less than you hear it.
But I also think it says, hear it. Listen to me. You don't have to answer it. You don't have to do anything for a moment, but could you hear what I'm saying?
There are two ways to read that first line. Almighty one who hears a poor man's prayer, or Almighty one who hears a poor man's prayer.
The Hebrew is not ambiguous in that way.
And the fact that he says, thanking you for your abundant grace, I find this really a pleading. You don't have to respond, you don't have to do what I ask, but just hear me.
Yeah. I pray in sorrow, I place my hopes in
you. It's so different from, you wouldn't know the same person wrote this as wrote to humans. His voice in addressing God is very different than his voice in addressing his peer or his other human beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does he really think? He's saying everything is so miserable, and then he thanks God for the grace that's shown to him. I mean, he didn't list any graces that were shown to him in his other poetry.
Is it possible that he has a patron who said, who gives him a bunch of things and says, could you write it in poetry, what I'm thinking, so it could be, might it be his words of somebody else's feelings?
And there's no one who writes about him that suggests that.
Okay.
Over how long a period of time did he write?
From the time he was 16 until his death.
He wrote about 15 or so years.
But in the first poem, he talks about what belongs to his heart and his soul. And who else is there in his heart and his soul except God? I mean, he doesn't trust the real world, the physical world. Mm-hmm. So you would think that his only real relationship is with God.
But even that's distant. I mean, he's reaching, right? It's like yearning.
God's
trying to connect with God, but he can't quite get
there. I mean, yes. Does one really hear God's answer? That's the other.
He's thanking God for God's abundant grace. So what is the grace that he's experiencing for which he's thankful?
What do you think from here, from this poem?
I think he's grateful for for breath, that he breathes, and he has his mind. I think it's a very humble poem, personally. Yeah, that's his gift.
What is his hope? He has a hope that makes his heart secure, and what is that hope? I mean, I'm not sure how secure it is, but what is his hope?
That his prayer is heard.
Look at the lines, like
to
one
understand.
Who dreams a dream obscure, trusting
understand.
The interpreter. Yeah. So my life is not, does not known to me.
Right.
And the dream is hidden from me, I'm trusting. You will be the interpreter. And my heart is secure in trusting that you will interpret my dream, my life.
Could it also...
He has thoughts that come to him. I mean, that's what he holds dear, you know, what he writes about. And, you know, the fact that he's a genius, you know, you have inspiration, you don't really necessarily know where it comes from, right? When you meet people like that who can write so profoundly on whatever topic they're writing about. You know, it's almost like a godlike quality. You don't know where it's really coming from. It just emanates from them. And, you know, he was brilliant. And I think he's thanking God for that
that he holds dear, that his inspiration, his writing, his spirituality.
I'm going to read you the last three lines in Hebrew and just suggest a slightly different read of it. And we have a scholar here, so I'm not suggesting anything other than just the interpretive right we all have to read a poem. Kecholem chalom satrum yiftach halev poter hine she'elati הקשב תחינתי, אותה אבקש, לא פחות ולא יותר. So, without the punctuation of our English translation, as one who dreams a hidden dream trusts the interpreter, this is my request. Listen to my plea. This I ask, nothing more, nothing less. Nothing less, nothing more. So, what is my request? To interpret this dream that is hidden from me. It's another way to read it. It's not, it doesn't go against the way the English is laid out.
Is there another?
He's also part of this... there is no one earthly that can share his thoughts or his feelings or anything. It's almost like he can only share this with God, and only God would be able to interpret, because he wouldn't accept that from any of his peers, ever. Because he is arrogant enough to say, I am way better than you. So there's only one place for him to go to have his life interpreted.
Is it possible that this was a commission, that he wrote it for someone else?
That's what I am.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a little weird, but a few weeks ago there was an article in the Times magazine section that a woman who was translating the Odyssey, that was the first female who's translated the Odyssey after 60-some-odd people. Men have translated the Odyssey, and the article focused on the first word and how it had been translated by many different people. And it's really, it sounds like a weird article, but it's really worth reading, because it really shows how you can completely change.
Mm-hmm. I can interpret.
How translation is really
interpretation.
Interpretation, and it's almost Talmudic, and I think he talked about that. You know, that you're taking this one word, which I don't remember now, and just taking it apart. And he gave a list. I don't know if Weber wrote it, of 35 different translations of that one opening. And they were all so different.
So the first line. I'm sorry, Judy. Please.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say that I was wondering whether some of what because he's writing things that he believes people, he's so above people that when you do that, you hope, I think, that it will be interpreted somehow, that it will be heard in some time and place, maybe just God, but maybe more than God, that I have to trust the interpreter, and that at some point all of this stuff I'm writing for the no audience that I can respect now, but maybe there is an ear and I want it heard. So God hearing it as kind of metaphor for it being heard and interpreted.
Anyway, some of the liturgical poems were commissioned. That's also, again, how he might, one of the sources of income for him, which is different from the religious poetry, not the liturgical poetry. And the first line of the Bible, first line of the Torah, has been radically interpreted in different ways that have made the difference in entire worldviews. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, translation's huge.
Yeah.
Okay, next poem. Yes, Rina.
this line, I ask for nothing less. But what he's asking for is a great deal. He's asking God to interpret all of his dreams, which is very powerful.
I want you to get me.
What does my life mean? Who doesn't want to know that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a foundational religious question, and it's one he's asking.
Right.
I'm trusting you to let me know what my life is about.
I'm just wondering what happened to him just before he wrote this. Because it has, to me, it has a different tone than the others. And
maybe he was writing them at the same time, because it's not necessarily... But he's addressing somebody different, right?
That's why I asked over how long the period of time did he write. It's from depending upon his date of death, within that time frame, it would be 15 to 20 years. So, I mean, people change.
My sense is that he can change quickly from one thing to another and back again,
yeah,
because his synapses are going so quickly. That, you know, it doesn't have to be any particular instant as much as it's a thought that comes and goes, but he can make it concrete by words.
You organize this by topic rather than chronologically, right?
So they are organized by topic. So I don't know if they can be organized chronologically. I don't know if they can be.
Before.
Right, we don't
know.
Maybe
his prayers weren't answered, and that's why
he got so depressed and angry. Yeah.
It's interesting to try to figure out who the real person is. Is he the angry, miserable, arrogant SOB, or is he the humble servant or seeker of God?
Depends if he's on his meds or not.
Yeah, well,
right.
Coming from a doctor.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, send the bill.
The next one. It's also beautiful. Somebody, the next poem.
Before I was, your kindness came to me when you made nothing be, creating me. Who was it wove my form? Who poured and fired my matter in the kiln? Who was it breathed the soul in me? Who opened Sheol's womb and let me go forth free? Who guided me till now from infancy? Who gave me thought, my gift, distinctively? True, to you I never can be more than clay. True, you made me, never I made me. I own my guilt. I do not say I strayed because some snake beguiled me craftily. How could I hide my sin from you? For see, before I was, your kindness came to me.
That's really, I like that.
It's beautiful.
Is the rhyme scheme the same in the...
He's trying to parallel the line. The rhyme scheme. He does sometimes.
So the sentence or the phrase, I own my guilt, it would seem such a contemporary statement. You know, I own my guilt. It's really interesting.
And why would he say he came from Sheol's womb?
Why?
Came from Sheol's womb.
Yeah.
So what's the
Sheol?
What's the reference?
Sheol is the deep, dark bottom. The grave.
The grave. Sort of.
Jacob says,
yes,
if you take
my
Benjamin,
my gray hair,
we'll go down to Sheol.
So from
so it may be maybe referencing some particular philosophical construct. I'm sorry. It looks like it is, but I can't explain it.
Why not a straight biblical reference?
Could be.
Yeah.
Except that Sheol is where you go when you die.
Yes, it's not real.
So unless it's referencing, you know, it's playing off, I guess a lot of people do. I mean, a lot of poets do. That death and birth, and there are euphemisms for vagina, which are, you know, the cave, the the place of death, of dark and death, but it's also the place of birth. So maybe, you know, there's a the womb, the Sheol's womb, and those are two graven womb that are layered in that way.
Cemetery is a Beit
Chaim. Right. Yeah, no, they use the euphemism, but...
Well, he talks about the snake who beguiled him. Mm-hmm. He had nothing to do with it. He was forced to do something by the snake.
But also, Sheol's womb could be... what is that? That when you die, you'll go back to return to the Maker?
Yeah.
So once you've died, now you're being reborn again.
Yeah.
Set free again, rebirth, maybe. Yeah. I was already there, now I've been set free again.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone down, and now I'm free again.
Or some place where souls exist, and when it's time for them to be born, they're released into life.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh. Right. He has a profound attachment to the belief that the soul is part of the soul. And we read it over and over in his poetry.
And it wasn't the snake who beguiled the man. And it's interesting that he puts it that way.
That's what he says. Mm-hmm. I own my own.
Yeah.
I'm not blaming anybody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's starting out with kindness. Before I was, it was kindness, your kindness. That's where I started.
Mm-hmm.
And
right. And when you made nothing, be creating me. Was it that time that your kindness came to? That's beautiful. Want to hear it one more time?
Mm-hmm.
I would. We hear it again, please.
Before I was, your kindness came to me. When you made nothing, be creating me. Who was it wove my form? Who poured and fired my matter in the kiln? Who was it breathed the soul in me? Who opened Sheol's womb and let me go forth free? Who guided me till now from infancy? Who gave me thought, my gift distinctively? True, to you I never can be more than clay. True, you made me, never I made me. I own my guilt. I do not say I strayed because some snake beguiled me craftily. How could I hide my sin from you? For see, before I was, your kindness came to me.
And it's very beautiful. The translator, Shenlin, when he, for example, who was it who wove my form, who poured, and he's following the Hebrew meter. And the way the line breaks.
And he also makes reference to who gave me thought, my gift distinctively. Like, I know that my thinking is my distinction. It's what makes me me.
And back to the, and who? Of course, we lose the sound of the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. So, me dropping to the middle paragraph. Mihu asheri kem tumunati umi atzmi b'chur yatzak p'ani. So we don't, and umi is the end before the next line. Also the power of the rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next one. Pardon me? I just glanced at my watch, so we'll be able to squeeze in the last two poems in this section. I'm going to leave you with the other that I prepared. You can take it home. Mm-hmm. And so these two are, you'll see how close they are. This is part of the liturgical, these are liturgical poems. And and This one, At Dawn I Come to You, is that the next one mm-hmm. you have? This one is in many prayer books. Starting with Sephardi, the Sephardi prayer book, and it made its way also into many Ashkenazi, not all, but many Ashkenazi prayer books too. Anyone want to read?
At dawn I come to you, my rock, my strength. I offer you a dawn and evening prayers. Before your majesty I stand in fear, because your eye observes my secret thoughts. What is there that man's mind and mouth can make? What power is there in my body's breath? And yet the songs of man delight you. Therefore I shall praise you while God's breath remains in me.
And I offer you, the Hebrew is, my dawn and my evening. So shachar, we have shacharit would be, mm-hmm. yeah. and here it's just shachar. Mm-hmm. And we have arvit, but here it's just erev, arvi.
So there's no word for prayers in the Hebrew. The translator added that?
Because, yeah. Mm-hmm. I set before you. So God is the author of the dawn and the evening. But it's understood. It's an accurate translation, but the Hebrew leaves it open.
I'm curious as to, therefore I shall praise you while God's breath remains in me, mm-hmm. and not you while your breath remains mm-hmm. in me.
Odecha, 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 Ve'od Tehye Nishmat Eloh Rabbi. It's also the rhythm is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And Eloha sounds like the breath. Mm-hmm. So you use that name for God because it's God's breath. Odecha ve'od tehye nishmat Eloh Rabbi. Eloha related to Allah.
I just noticed, and yet the songs of man delight you. Therefore I shall praise you.
And so that was a nice segue to the last poem. I didn't read it.
At morning and at evening I seek you. I offer you my face and outspread palms. For you I yearn, to you I turn, your grace to earn, like someone at my door who asks for alms. The heavens do not have room for you to dwell, and you have a palace
and
in
yet,
my mind.
And yet.
Yeah, I slur. And yet you have a palace in my mind. For in my heart I hide your holy name. Your love spills over, cannot be confined. And so I praise God with my poetry, while yet he breathes a living soul in me.
It reminds me of, that's a poem we read in the introduction originally, sort of looking inward and looking upward and outward, that mm-hmm. God is inside and God is confined yet
mm-hmm.
infinite.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you breathe the soul, so Elohai Neshama, Shenafachta, you breathe the soul in me.
I don't know if there's any symbolism to this, you know, morning and evening, which was also in the yeah. previous poem about sort of the span of his life, right? My whole being, my whole life is before you. I seek you.
And here, shachar, dawn, is used as dawn and not as the prayers at the dawn.
The middle paragraph has a Hasidic ring to me, with the heavens not having enough room for you, and your love's for in my heart I hide your holy name. The idea of the urn breaking into so many pieces and a little piece being in each of us.
Your love spills over, cannot be confined. I mean, this side by side with this other poetry of ugliness and anger, of venom. Mm-hmm.
To go back to what Jean said, it really makes you wonder the sequence of these poems. Mm. Was he able to switch from despair to these sublime prayers back and forth, or did he go through larger periods of time, a blue period, a happier time?
It's in relationship. I think when he's in relationship with God, you feel this positive, loving emotion. When he's in relationship with the real world, it turns ugly and painful.
And that's a continuum. It's not like green period, blue period. He's on a continuum with this. Because he's searching. So he has to go from the reality to something that he can't see, feel, or taste, or touch, but there he can find his beauty. And he goes from one to the other. I don't think that it stops and then starts. I think he just... There's a certain continuity for him. That's just sort of who he is.
And I'm going to send you home with two poems. And in one of them, he describes a palace in the country, which is in stark contrast to this notion. The heavens do not have room for you to dwell, and yet you have a palace in my mind. He describes in very vivid and physical detail this palace, which, as I understand, again, my understanding is limited, as I understand, is not a metaphor. He's describing a real place. So it's not like a Kabbalist metaphor. But, so there's one poem which is very short, and one poem which is the palace, and I'll give you the whole rest of it, which is many pages long. I wanted to give you, many pages long. Okay? And I'm going to take a moment and enjoy them. We will be meeting next.